Okay, Gedavach, thank you for coming. For tonight, we're going to be discussing the question. Gedavach, please take. We're going to be discussing the question of when we're dealing, especially in chinuch, but it really applies in all of life at every age stage. How do we distinguish and differentiate between whether something is driven by OCD, and we'll elaborate on exactly what that is, in contrast to whether something is driven by Yirat Shamayim, from what we would congratulate and we would encourage. We would want people to develop in Yirat Shamayim, in being able to serve the Ribono Shel Olam. We want people to be, maybe even we could say, based on Lashonos of the Rambam, obsessed with the love of Hashem, with the fear of Hashem, with serving Hashem. These are things that we want, and if so, how do we make sure that it's coming from a healthy place and not from a place that is unhealthy? Obviously, people can exhibit anxiety symptoms. I'll just give you one sort of visual. Imagine a secular psychologist came to B'nai Brak, and he had no previous interactions with the Haredim in B'nai Brak, and he sees this young Rav Yashiv sitting in the Beis Medrash learning day and night and learning more and more and more. The psychologist would be able to check off many of the attributes in the DSM, that is the handbook for mental health, that this kid is exhibiting OCD. He's obsessed. That's the O in OCD. He's obsessed with learning Torah, and to the extent that it's not healthy, it's too much, it's not balanced. But of course, we know that not to be true. So the question is, how do we develop a more clear understanding and a methodology to be able to differentiate between these two, to be able to Rebbe, here's to be able to differentiate between these two, so that we can know what's healthy and what's unhealthy. Okay, so what I want to start with in our source packet here is actually source number 2. This is a copy of the Sefer Etzos V'Hadrachos. It's a fascinating Sefer. The whole Sefer is a collection of letters that Rabbi Dr. Greenwald wrote to the Stipler Gaon in B'nai Brak, and he asked many mental health questions. As we'll see, a number of them involve anxiety and OCD type questions. And again, we're going to get more into the heart of what is anxiety, but just to open up the discussion, we can see the Hasha'ela in source number 2 here in the copied part. Hasha'ela, the question that Rabbi Dr. Greenwald asked the disciple of Gaon is, Avrei choshev she'eino yochel lechaven daito kishikori shema. A choshev kol yunga man, he was not able to have kavana when he was reading Shema. V'chozer al-kol teva v'teva harbe pa'amim. And he's reviewing every word of Shema over and over and over again, many times, so that he can enunciate each word properly. And he also is afraid that he did not have the right kavana while he's saying it, not pronouncing it, not having the right kavana. And in general, he's worried, maybe I didn't have the right kavana to be able to say to fulfill my mitzvah of Kriya Shema. Maybe I didn't have kavana appropriately. It ends up taking him to say Shema a very long time. It takes him a very long time. So the Stipler Gaon answers, responding to Rabbi Greenwald. He says, "V'davar hacholesh akriya shma olos man rab ma'od." Concerning this matter that the ill person, so right off the bat, he calls him someone with a choli, a sickness, an illness, that kriya shma is taking him so long. Ani rogel v'chi agav na lomer lom. Rabbi, if I can just give you this here. All he has to do is say the words in the siddur. And even if it appears to him, so I mean he himself could potentially say, I'm sure I didn't have kavana. That's what it seems to me. He should continue to read in the words in the siddur. Don't worry about that feeling of I did not read Kriya Shema appropriately. Kiva emes betit pnimiyas yodeh masha omrim umevim lashon hakodesh. Deep down inside, he knows what he's saying as long as he understands Hebrew. Ba'afiluim enu mevim lashon hakodesh ha'akopanim sha'kriya zu hi kabbalas ol malchus shemayim. Just reading it itself is kabbalas ol malchus shemayim. Umezem makai mitzvot Kriya Shema. Ba'atzer lomer lahem, and this is the key. Ba'atzer lomer lahem rayos v'svaros. It is utter for a rav, for a rebbe, for a therapist, to try to start giving proofs and svaros, explanations, in terms of what the discipler just said. Because saying the words is enough of called Kabbalah. Don't tell him any of this. Because if you tell him any reasons why he really is Yotzei Kriya Shema, he is fulfilling his mitzvah, Kikol Masha Mosifin Lo Ta'amim, all the reasons you add for him, who choser listor levato legamri kol Masha Omrim Lo, he ends up just refuting and destroying and giving all sorts of reasons why you're wrong, kasher nira bechush, as we see, rak tzarech lomer davar mukhlet lo shum tamim klal. So there's more interesting things here, but for our purposes, that's what I wanted to read. You just have to tell him something cut and dry, very clear, and that's it. You move on, and he moves on, and doesn't have to worry about being mekayim this mitzvah. So we see already in this she'ela, in this tshuva, from Rabbi Dr. Greenwald to the stipler Gon, that the stipler is telling us already a very important yesod, a very important principle in both understanding OCD and then treating OCD. So let's first back up a little bit and define what exactly is OCD. OCD is a subset of anxiety. Anxiety is a very good thing that the Ribono Shalom gave to us. Anxiety helps us in dangerous situations. If you're hiking in the woods and you see something big and brown and furry in the distance looking at you and starting to walk towards you, it's great that we start to feel on edge. The blood flows differently in our bodies to allow us to have more energy, to be able to have heightened sensitivity, and our senses are heightened in their abilities. We go into what they call fight, flight, or freeze. All of those necessary for survival. Hashem gave us the midah, or the reflex of anxiety that's neurological and affects our whole nervous system and takes over the body with tremendous chachma. We can only see the tip of it, I'm sure, but we can see the tremendous chachma in a human being having anxiety. What makes something an anxiety disorder, and really what makes anything a mental health disorder, is if it causes dysfunction. So let's just say, for example, a person has a tremendous irrational fear of driving over a bridge. Or let's go back in time, before there were cars and people traveled too far, riding their horse over a bridge. And in those days, he lived in a town in Nebraska, and there were no bridges anywhere for 200 miles in every direction, and everyone lived their lives never traveling over bridges. It just wasn't a part of their lifestyle. So even though we could put him in a situation where he would have a phobia that causes dysfunction in his life, we're not going to diagnose him at all with a dysfunction, because it doesn't affect his life in any practical way. So what happens with an anxiety disorder is, in practical ways, we're seeing this anxiety response become triggered and take over his whole mental faculties, even though he's not seeing any bear in the distance. Or he's not even in the woods. He's in a classroom where it's perfectly safe, yet the anxiety is attacking him and taking over his whole menuchas ha-nefesh, his whole sense of self. He's distracted by it. And sometimes you can point to and you can discover particular things that the person's anxious about. Again, they may be very irrational, like this person's looking at me, the Rebbe's not paying attention to me, my teacher, I'm worried that something's going to happen to them, I'm worried I might get sick, I touched something that's dirty, all sorts of things that could be driving the anxiety. Sometimes it's just an anxious feeling that the person can't even describe. It's very hard for them to even describe what exactly is the anxious thought that's affecting them. They have a very hard time of even being able to figure out. And that's something that we call in the mental health community general anxiety disorder, where you can't even point to a particular thing. It's very related to the neurochemicals in the brain, and that's why medicines can help sometimes. And in general, on this topic, we'll leave time for questions and answers at the end, but I want to just provide a basic introduction to this topic. So that's anxiety, and that's how anxiety really is something that's good for us, but again, when it is acting up in ways in which is not appropriate for us, so then it keeps us on edge, it makes us exhausted all the time. After that experience with the bear in the woods, the person would healthily be exhausted and need to recover, and like, Baruch Hashem, I survived. So great, the anxiety served its purpose, but if you're always feeling that way, and you're never able to sort of refresh and restart, and there's nothing dangerous to make you feel that way, so then it's something which becomes a disorder, because it's disordering, it's causing dysfunction in the person's life. So OCD stands for obsessive compulsive disorder. It's a subset, it's a subcategory of anxiety. The O, obsession, really just means anxiety. That's all it means. It means the person's obsessed about something, meaning they're feeling very anxious about something. So let's say a person who is obsessed, we mentioned before, about germs, about touching a doorknob. And that's something which gives them tremendous anxiety if they touch it, or if they think they're going to have to touch it. So then that's something that causes them to be distracted from everything else. That's all they can obsessively think about. Their heart rate is speeding up. Their breathing is speeding up. And it's very unhealthy for them to live that way when it comes to touching a doorknob, which is a perfectly safe action. By the way, usually when people have a reason for anxiety, it's based on something real. That means, yeah, there's like logic to say that the doorknob maybe is the dirtiest place in the room because everyone's touching it. But when we would do any sort of scientific research on that, we would discover it has no actual significant risk to anybody's health to help to touch the doorknob, and therefore it's considered safe. And we as a society do this all the time. There are all sorts of things that we do that have some extremely small level of risk, and the ability to live our lives tolerating in a comfortable way the risk of life in general is something that's key to living a healthy life. Somebody once described anxiety to me as the unending quest for certainty, for absolute certainty. There's nothing we could really be absolutely certain about. It's everything has levels of risk, but at such tiny levels we ignore the tiny risks involved. So this person, for example, has that obsession. They're worried and they're constantly thinking about, if I touch that doorknob, I could get very sick, it could injure me, the person could even die, they're thinking. The C that makes OCD unique, instead of it just being a phobia or a particular anxiety, is that there's a compulsion part. The compulsion is something which is more like a unhealthy band-aid. It's something they can do to either avoid feeling the anxiety altogether, or usually they'll feel the anxiety and then do that to avoid continuing to feel the anxiety, or they have to go through it, but by doing this compulsion, it allows them to, in the short term, and that's the key word, start to feel a little bit more calm. So for the doorknob example, the person might roll their sleeve over their hand in order to open and close the doors. Or they might hope or look for, they might pass a closer bathroom that has a doorknob for a bathroom that they can push open. And these are real cases, with their elbow, because they don't want to touch the doorknob. So that's the compulsion that they're doing. And the compulsion makes them feel better. Sometimes it's after the fact. So a person is worried that the door is not locked in their home. So they go down to double check. And they check it. Okay. Then they go back. Wait, maybe I didn't lock it. Maybe I'm not remembering right. Okay, go back and check. Lock it again. Unlock it. Lock it. Some people have particular numbers that they're obsessed with. If I unlock, lock 7 times, and they'll count to 7, now I feel like, okay, like something clicked in my brain, now I feel like the door is locked. And it can obviously, you can imagine many circumstances where this can become very disruptive. There can be all sorts of kashrus things in the kitchen where OCD can become, again, we want to differentiate between Yerushalayim and OCD, that's the point here. But a person can have highly irrational habits, which are obviously OCD, where the only way for them to appropriately wash the dishes afterwards, and before putting in the dishwasher, they have to wash it 5, 6, 7 times, over and over and over again. Washing hands, whether it has to do with tumah or dirt. So the religious form of OCD is actually called scrupulosity, like scrupulous, like being scrupulous, which is being like religious, that has an English connotation. So scrupulosity is the religious subset of OCD, which is a subset of anxiety. So the person will wash their hands many times to the point that their hands are chapped and bleeding, and it's very unhealthy. So we can see clearly in those cases that it's OCD that's at play. So when we're talking about the C, the compulsion can have different styles, but it's all about trying to give the person relief. That's what it's all about. That now I feel a little bit more calm. But what is notorious about the C and why it's so unhealthy is that it never lasts. It never actually makes the person feel better. It only very short term calms them down, and very quickly afterwards they start to worry again. and they have to go through more and more and more compulsions. And actually the way that we understand the brain works through the idea, and we'll get more into this, of repetition and habits and hergel and chazal, is the more in an unhealthy way a person goes through a certain habit. So a bachur is not waking up for yeshiva one time and then he picks himself up and goes the next day, that's one thing. But if he doesn't go for 3 days in a row, and then 4 days in a row, it's going to be much harder for him to wake up that fifth day because he's already started a routine, an unhealthy habit. And the same thing with any of these types of habits. So when the person is getting used to using the compulsion to calm him down, it starts to reinforce itself automatically in the brain. And it becomes this program that becomes very hard to break out of, that this is what he has. He has this obsessive feeling and thought, and he does the compulsion to calm him down, and very soon again the obsession comes back. The D, like we said, is very important. OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder, it actually is causing disorder in his life. Like we said before, it has to be that we can see practically in his life it's causing some sort of dysfunction and disorder. Okay, so a phobia, like we said, could be the obsession without the compulsion, and so can other anxieties. Okay, so the idea of anxiety, by the way, in general, being traced back to both genetics and our environment, so that's both nature and nurture, has been shown many times over. There's a high genetic component to people being predisposed to anxiety, so that can certainly play a role, as well as the environment that we find ourselves in, nurture. And there's a whole new field called epigenetics, which is a huge new breakthrough in science that they're discovering now, that if a person is affected by their environment enough, over and over and over again, for enough amount of time, we're talking about years, it could actually start to make a difference in their genetics. That's epigenetics. That means that a person who does not have any predisposition for anxiety at all, but they live through some extremely high anxiety tense time, say the Holocaust, and for years they're on edge, as they should be, because it's an extremely dangerous place and anxious, anxiety-filled place to be. But for years they're feeling and living through with those feelings, it actually can make genetic mutations in their genes that then can be passed down to children, even though the genes were not there originally, which is fascinating. Okay. So we see, based on all of this, that the stipler is telling us, we read in his answer, that when the person is struggling with saying Kriya Shma, he's feeling like, I can't do this, I'm not having Kavana, that the stipler gives Rabbi Greenwald a bunch of reasons, but he says, do not tell the person the reasons at all. And the purpose of this is because this is not a rationally driven fear. This is anxiety. It's irrational, even though it can have notes of rationality, like we mentioned. So he's saying, make sure not to get into the reasons with this person, because he's always going to figure out a way. The anxiety, the way I like to discuss it with clients, it's almost like the anxiety wants to survive. It's almost like it has a life of its own in your brain, and it wants to keep itself alive. And as so long as you try to figure out a way that you shouldn't be worried about it, it's really just a muscle, but the anxiety will come back with all sorts of reasons why that's not true, that's wrong, really you should be worried about it, that person's just trying to hurt you, all sorts of things. And it's important that in the therapy process you have a good relationship with that person, that they can be open about all of these things. So when we understand now the idea of anxiety and OCD, how they affect a person, so let's talk a little bit about what's the treatment for OCD, and that's going to help us just finally sharpen our view exactly of what OCD is, and then we can come back to Yerushalayim and understand how very clearly different they are. The treatment we touched on already for OCD can be lighter interventions, but often if it's really affecting the person, you have to get to more intense and deeper interventions that should only be done by a professional who has a lot of experience and training in doing them. The lighter interventions can be things as simple as acceptance therapy. Basically is the idea that the person is just recognizing that the irony of how anxiety works in the brain is the more you push it out, the more it stays. It's sort of like, in general, how do you ever not think about something? If I tell you not to think about a pink elephant, then that's what you're thinking about. So the answer is, you think about something else. You start thinking about something else and try to think about something else, and eventually the other thought goes away. So there's a little bit of like a paradox there. So similar with OCD, the more you tell yourself to calm down, the more you're thinking about this, and your brain actually sort of at subconscious levels, quote unquote, will be asking itself, why do I have to constantly be telling myself to calm down? There's like a cognitive dissonance there, that the brain is like a contradiction, and the way to resolve it simply would be, because it really is dangerous, because there is something to be worried about. So acceptance therapy is just a very light intervention for lighter cases that can work, where you get the person to recognize, it's okay that I have this feeling of anxiety. It's okay. I have this feeling of anxiety. It's okay. And I'm going to live my life with this feeling of anxiety. And the paradox of it is the more you embrace it, the more it tends to go away in the opposite direction. The more you live your life with, okay, so I'll have it. I can still live a happy life, a fulfilled life. I'll have this voice in my head telling me that there's danger, but, you know, it's okay. And the more you speak that way and try to feel that way and hear people telling you that and try to write about that and do other techniques to integrate that into your life, the more you actually calm down from the intense anxiety thought. So that's one approach. Obviously, relaxation techniques like slow breathing and mindfulness, where you pay attention to everything around you, every little detail. We're not going to go into detail in all these, but these are just ways to get the person to relax. And some even reassurance. Reassurance, some basic education, this is not so dangerous. But what happens if those are not working? Because most of these ideas, a Rebbe, an Amora, a Manal, and a principal can give this over to a student. Most of the time, these ideas. You know, it's good to have some training in what's out there, different styles and different approaches, but those are pretty simple interventions. The more clinical intervention that's out there is something called exposure and response prevention, ERP. And essentially, it really is built on the exposure. The response prevention part, RP, is really just for the OCD, where there's a compulsion, and we don't want them doing that compulsion, so preventing the compulsion. But it's all about exposure, for anxiety in general and for OCD specifically. And essentially, exposure works, like we said before, by exposing the person to the fear. And the more we are exposed to something that frightens us, the less afraid we are, right? A soldier in training, a big part of his training is being around guns and bullets and all of these things a lot, because now when they're in the battlefield, there's not so much shock effect, because you don't get shocked by something that you've seen and been around many, many times. That's how our psyche works. It's how Hashem made us. I said already before, Hergel, the idea of becoming regular. It could happen with Averus, like we said before. It could happen with mitzvahs. The more regular we become and accustomed to something, the less of a shock effect it has on us. So exposure therapy is the gold standard for treating real clinical OCD and anxiety. And there are many ways this can look. But let's take one example that we were saying, where the person doesn't want to touch the doorknob. So he's afraid of the germs on the doorknob. So what the therapist would do is the therapist would try to expose that person to the fear of touching the doorknob. What a well-intentioned teacher or Rebbe may do is, and there's logic to it, is, listen, I have a simple etza for you. Just put on gloves. You put on gloves, thin gloves, and you're good for it to go. And the bacher, the student might say, let me try that. And they're calmed down. They're good. It actually works for a little bit of time. What tends to happen when you do these not advised approaches is the person ends up with other things to become frightened by. The OCD takes on slightly other forms, even if it maintains itself based on germs. It'll be other areas of germs that the brain will quickly shift to if you did. And then the gloves themselves can have all sorts of issues with them. But that sounds like such a simple idea. It's not just that that idea is not treating the OCD, it's actually making it worse. Because by having the person put the gloves on, once again, like I said, the brain is asking itself, why am I wearing gloves when it's not cold outside? Because I can't touch the doorknob. Okay, doorknobs are dangerous. And you're actually strengthening and carving out that neural pathway in the brain that doorknobs are dangerous because of germs, and it's making it much, much worse. And it becomes way more intense for them to not wear gloves. And even when they're wearing gloves, there's still going to be other areas of intensity. Instead, what we want to do is exposure therapy, and this should only be done again by someone who's accustomed to doing this and knows what to do and how to do and what not to do. But the idea is that you want to expose them to it. So for example, with the doorknob, we might have the person put their hand right next to the doorknob. And as their hand is there, they may start to feel some anxiety. And we tell them, think about the thoughts you're having about how dangerous this situation is to be in. Don't distract yourself. Because exposure and hergel and becoming accustomed to something requires that you're paying attention to it. If I'm blasting music in his face and telling him to stare at some video or something while his hand is right next to the doorknob, and therefore he's distracted, then he's not actually exposing himself to the anxiety at all. So therefore, that's not going to help us. We want the person to expose himself to the thought of the danger that he's feeling. And again, it sounds paradoxical. Essentially, we're having this person repeat over and over and over in his brain, I feel like, because that's the truth, we're not saying the reality is, I feel like touching that doorknob is very dangerous to my health. I feel like touching that doorknob is very dangerous to my health. Over and over and over. And there are many types of exposures that can be used. One is just in office. You can have the person actually go to a doorknob and put their hand next to it. It has to be something that's causing some anxiety. So let's say we say that. He says, that's too much for me. I can't start with that. All right, let's find something lighter. Here's a picture printed out of a doorknob. Oh, that's easy. I can look at that all day long. And that's not exposure. It has to be something that causes some anxiety that can be focused on purposely, and over time it actually usually gets a little worse and then starts to get better. So that's the essential treatment for it. Right? It works the same way with phobias. If a person has an irrational fear of spiders, you would have the spider on the other side of the door, maybe bring it inside in a cage. But again, the whole time that they're being exposed to it, it has to be that they're thinking over and over again, I am worried that spider is going to attack me. I am worried that spiders are so dangerous they can't even be in the same room as them. And you want them to be focused on that thought. There are methodologies where you can have the person write down scripts over and over again. You can have the person just say the fear, even sometimes when they're not in front of it. But they're constantly exposing it. I've had more extreme cases where I've had a kid fall asleep with an audio script of himself talking about his worry, and there was a repeat function on the MP3 player that would repeat it over and over and over and over and over again. The kid was actually listening to it throughout. In that case, he was able to sleep like that. He was listening to it at least subconsciously while he was sleeping to that messaging. And the more he's exposed, that she's exposed to the fear and the worry, the less frightening and worrisome it becomes. It's very important to note, the point is not to eradicate the anxiety. That itself will produce anxiety. Like, oh, I still think it's there. It's okay if it's there. We're trying to lower the volume on the anxiety. Okay, that's an overview on how this works. Just to tell you how far it goes, I wouldn't necessarily go this far, but I have a colleague here in Baltimore who, when he does trainings on exposure therapy, he will dump out a pack of gum on the floor, on the carpeted floor, at least that's where I saw it. And he will then pick up a piece from the floor and make a shahako and eat it and say, who's going to join me? Because we can't ask our clients to do things that we ourselves are not going to do. So don't worry, I don't have a pack of gum. So we're not going to do that. There's a guy named John Grayson, a non-Jew in Philadelphia, who wrote the book on a lot of this stuff. And he even takes it further. You can reserve your own judgment on him, but he actually goes around the corner of his building in Philadelphia and has people work their way up when it comes to germs to just for a second touch their tongue to the outside of the city dumpster. Just for a second, let's just touch your tongue to the dumpster to be able to show yourself that it's not inherently dangerous. Again, I don't think I would do that myself, but just to show you how far it can go. Okay, so Yiras Shamayim is something that we have in Yiddishkeit that non-religious people, which generally is the secular world around us, they don't have much of a connection with. So when it comes to the idea that there's some worry, there's some appropriate worry that am I doing the right thing? It shouldn't just be that if I have if I mix two things in a pot or I have two things that were next to each other and I don't know what the halacha is, it shouldn't just be like, I'm sure it's fine. There should be, if there's a legitimate safek, there should be like, oh, I want to make sure. There's a part of me, you could describe it as, I'm worried. I want to make sure that I'm keeping the standards of kashrus. So that means that word, that worried word, can be used appropriately when it comes to Yiddishkeit. And if that's the case, so that brings us to our contrast here. How do we connect them? So let's take a look at source number one on the sheet. The Medrash Shmuel and Avos tells us, Ha Chiddush B'Simcha, She'im Eino Lomid B'Simcha, V'Hatorah Yalav L'Torah. The novel idea here that he's telling us about Simcha, about happiness, is that if a person does not learn with happiness and the Torah is just a burden on him, Sof Yifrosh Min Alimud, he will separate in the end from learning. V'Yila L'Shav, and it will all be for naught. Amnam Kasher Yoma B'Simcha V'Shirim, if he learns with Simcha and singing, Az Ba'ahavasa Yishke Tamid, then through that I think is part of where part of the Rambam language that we took from before, then through the love, tremendous deep love, that constant Vatorah Vasimcha Achim Heim. This is words that I know, I think they were going to put it into song form, or they did put it into song form, but very powerful words. Vatorah Vasimcha Achim Heim. Torah and Simcha are brothers. V'lo yispardu, they cannot be separated. Ki pikudi Hashem Sharm Sam Kelev, which goes in the opposite direction also, by the way. We'll talk about what actual Simcha is, but you can't really have true Simcha without Torah, just like you can't have true Torah, true Avodas Hashem, without Simcha. V'od shehi ba'atzma haisa sha'ashuv shal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it itself was part of the enjoyment of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, Moshe Gazer Ve'ayah Sha'ashurim Yom Yom Mesachakas L'chon B'chol Eis V'kiven Sh'chok Asa Le'alakim Eina Shor B'makom Apsos Ala B'makom Simcha. Since it has this joyous component to it, the Torah itself cannot rest in a place of sadness, only in a place of Simcha. So, what is Simcha exactly? I'm sure you're all aware, as Mechanchim and Mechaneches, the idea of Simcha is not thrilling. It's not something which makes a person even necessarily laugh or even necessarily smile. Simcha is contentness. It can be more similarly compared to Menuchas HaNefesh, that a person has content with what they're doing, with their daily schedule, with their lives, with the people in their lives, how they treat the people in their lives, the service, the way that they're serving Hashem, provides a person true Simcha. That's contentness. But definitely just random sadness, and certainly clinical depression, where the person just feels low and down, is going to be a contradiction to that feeling of Simcha. So, that, I think, is going to be the crux for how we can understand where we can look to determine whether a particular behavior in a person is coming from OCD or Yirat Shemayim and Avas Hashem, etc. What is the source? What is the source of what is driving that person's behavior? We have many extreme cases that I mentioned, right? We're not touching the doorknob and washing the dishes 7 times and all these things that go way above and beyond. But even if we come to more subtle cases and we want to understand what's really driving the person, what you want to look for is this person being driven by a sense of menuchas ha-nefesh, by a sense of it's fulfilling to me. There's a sense of, there's a good feeling that I'm serving the Ribono Shalom, that I'm being machmir here. It gives me a sense of being closer to Hashem. It's all positive feelings. Even Yiras HaOnesh, which we could say is the lowest level of serving Hashem, that there is a certain fright of punishment. It's still not sitting and shaking and not able to think, to be so distracted by the fear that I can't learn, that I can't go and do my next mitzvah sayom. I'm going to miss davening because I'm so defeating the whole purpose of recognizing that there's a Ribono Shel Olam, that there's Schar Va'Onesh. And certainly at the higher levels of Avas Hashem, it would look totally different. It's all driven by love and a wanting of connection to the Ribono Shel Olam. And by Yiras HaRoumimus, by being in awe of the Ribono Shel Olam's creation, of the Malchus of the Ribono Shel Olam of Hashem, the great kingdom of the whole world, that He's created the whole world, and I have a potential to have connection to Him. All that, obviously, if you can really talk to the inside of that person, you have good rapport with him, you will hear ideas like, I'm so happy that I have this opportunity. It gives me such a sense of menuchas ha-nefesh, of contentness, of real, true simcha. That's what we want to be looking for. A great litmus test for this can be, where it's confusing, can be, let's read another tshuva from the stipler, and then we'll take it out from there. If you look at source number 3 here, so Asha'ela, Bachar B'Yeshiva, Baal Kishrin, Yosir Meharagim. You have a bacher in yeshiva who is very, very smart. Shesovu yisurim noroyim mizeh shekol pam sheyesh lo safek ma la'asos ve'inyan ma o she'iru lo shum davar shegoyim lam tzar nefesh o sheyesh lo agmas nefesh mishum davar az osa gedar o shvua la'asos o shelo la'asos shum davar. Basically, you have a bacher in a yeshiva. He's a very smart, capable bacher, but he's in tremendous pain because whenever he's not sure whether he's doing the right thing or not, or how to act in a certain situation, and he's down and out, he starts making nedarim and shavuos, which have these promises and these vows, which have tremendous implications in halacha. V'chein pa'amim asa neder lasses kol mamono l'tzdaka. In order to get himself to not do something, let's say, he'll make a neder that if I do that thing, I am going to give all my money to tzedaka. V'chein kayotzit var ma'elu, and other similar ideas. V'yachol lasses shvuos v'nedarim kam upon b'yom v'gorim las matzar rav. So again, obviously, in many cases, it's going to be very clear. We're not talking about someone who, in a particular case, made a neder or shvua, which we do not recommend ever. But in a particular case, let's just say made a neder or shvua once in 10 years, and like we're deciding is that this is someone who you see how many times it just quickly grows and escalates. However, Rebbeim and Moras can pick up on these things earlier in the process, and that's why for them it can actually be much more subtle than this. But this obviously has developed for a while, and he's making nedarim and shvuas multiple times a day. Says the stipler going, I received your letter of Adabra Anashim Ha'osim Shvuos Nadarim Ha'adeshuvs Kiyotzvazah Kam Pam Bo Eilai Tzirim Ka'elu. Numerous times, said the stifler, young people, young children, let's call them teenagers, have come to me with these pains, says the stifler. And his barashim sovel mizeh naroz of the cholivam rotz and lipatim mizeh, and they have tremendous pain and they want to get out of this state. That's a big clue already. Achenim sholtim alatzman, they can't. Ve'achar shabal l'fana yastir. So I would give them advice. Sheyishlo l'gaon maran arav mibrisk, that they should go ask the brisker rav. The heishiv lo agona now, and the brisker rav answered shalochal lo neder v'lo shvu. That the neder and the shvu is not kal. Ki lo nasa v'das, it's not considered as having made v'das with real knowledge and intent, and therefore it doesn't count. Okay, not because they're a shotem, it's just that that gets into the technicalities a little bit of when certain nedarim are really, the person is making them for other reasons, not because they really want the neder to be chal. Va'od shehin begedra anusim, they are considered like an honest, they're not held responsible for these actions. It's not something that's in their control. Generally, I will tell them simply and firmly, and I'm also combining with what I'm saying the idea that we make an announcement on Erev Rosh Hashanah by Hataras Nadarim. We make an announcement that all the Nadarim and Shavuos that we will make will be Batal. So I'm using that also, but the point is, do not tell them what my reasonings are. I've worked with many Rabbanim in the city with cases of people, mostly who I work with as teenage boys, but I work with some adult males as well. And in all the cases with Rabbi Hopfer, with Rabbi Berger, and with many other Rabbanim in the city, I will have, it will be understood from the start that if what we're dealing with is anxiety, the Rav is not going to tell them the reason. Because as soon as you start going down that path, they're going to try to argue with all of this, and maybe that reason, no, maybe not, maybe this case is different. Also, they will only answer one time. So if the person's asking, is it okay that I wash negovaser like this? Is that okay? Does that count? The Rav will say, yes. And if you have any other sfeikus, and this is after, of course, he has confirmation from a mental health professional that this is what the person's struggling with. And if you have any other questions about it, I'm not answering them. I'm answering all your questions now. The answer is it's okay. Now the person is going to, not maybe, will come back in their minds to, but today was a little different than normal. Today I poured in water just a little bit on a different angle, a little bit differently. And the Rav will not answer their question. They'll say, I have a question. What's your question? No, I'm not answering that question. Not even I answered it already. Because the more you give in to the clinical anxiety and OCD, the more that they're going to continue to go down that path. That's like putting on the gloves. the answering of the psak constantly is like putting on the gloves to try to avoid the anxiety, and it actually paradoxically reinforces the anxiety. So the point is that when it comes to these cases, in general, it's very important to have a chashuva posek that you're working together with, of course, in all of these cases, when it revolves around religious things, for sure. But what we're seeing is that at the root of it is somebody who's in tsar, somebody who's in sadness, somebody who feels very little menuchas hanefesh. They're lacking menuchas hanefesh. Not somebody who feels like in doing these nedarim and shvuos, I'm feeling closer to Hashem. That's not what you're getting the sense of at all. And that's what you want to try to look for, to be able to differentiate between Yirat Shamayim, Avas Hashem, versus OCD. So, there are some interesting questions I want to get into. I want to leave time for questions from you also, but let's take a look at just one, the last source, and then we'll wrap it up from there. So in this source, Rabbi Greenwald asks, sorry, it's a little small. Avrek Yikar, Ha'erech, Tamad Chacham, Gadol, Shesobo, Neros, Mizeh, She'eshlo. This is source 4. Machashava shel avodah zarah b'shasha osek b'torah. U'beprat b'shasha tfila. Kishmachav lomar shem Hashem yisparach. O b'shasha kore b'shmona esrei. Az nofel b'machshavto machshavas avodah zarah b'chein pa'amim. Kishashokha lahagbiya chepetza ola. Az ola b'dayto adinyin shuhu korea mishtachav l'avodah zarah. U'muvin she'ena motza menucho l'nafsho. There you go. V'ishko v'chol b'nei b'esorot v'chol. So essentially what you have is you have a kol yom gaman who is having tremendous worries because he is worried that every time he says Hashem's name, he's thinking about avodah zarah. And he's doing a huge avera when he's davening, especially. And when he bends down to pick things up, he's worried that he's having in mind that he's bowing down to avodah zarah. And this is a tremendous choli, this is a tremendous illness. It's taking away all his menuchas and nefesh. So the stipler answers, Kvar kastavti a lot on this. Shadat nasev shekol elu amachashavos habilti tahoros shel hanidon ein bahem mamish v'avale v'ahuda amru v'sofar tachulin sirah kamachavin. Okay, so he adds on this. Let's get to the next paragraph. V'etav ktsas eitzos. Yahayali gamkein esek im bachar yakar echadsha asher nizbalbal b'machshavos avodah zarah. I once had a case like this. So you just see how many cases there are around like this. And it's bar. Ki shaholo ma'ot sha'asa l'fnei ha'tfila mesiras modash u'misfal ha'das ha'arizal v'ataz v'ashach v'amagin avram. He announces before he davens to himself. He whispers, I am hereby going to be davening al das all the kavanos, all of the meanings that were given by all the gedolei poskim in what davening should be. V'zeh she'tapalti imo haya chassid. He happened to be a chassid. V'amar gamkein al das v'al shem tov v'atzamach tzedek. I had those for him. V'achakach v'shat ha'tzvila yizkavishu mispalo v'yizchav v'tzadik meforsam. Okay, so I added this for in terms of him being a chassid. Somebody that in his eyes, if it would be al das that person, that would be tremendous tefillah. And that's what's going to help you daven without machshavas rose. So it's not clear if he's saying that lamaisa that person. Yeah, it sounds like he's saying, this person came back to the stifler and said, thank you, this helped me tremendously, which meant it allowed him to add that acceptance therapy that we said before, to accept that, you know what, I might have these random thoughts of avodah zarah while I'm davening, but it doesn't matter, because I already announced everything, all my davening is going to be al das, the right kavanos, al das Hashem. And therefore it helped me tremendously because now I still have, right? He's not saying I didn't, now eventually he is saying the thoughts went away, which is exactly the paradox of anxiety treatment. That you'll have these treatment methodologies where you're saying it's okay that you have that thought in your head. It's okay that you have that thought in your mind, but leave it there. That's okay. That's not a big deal. Leave it there. And that tends to make the thought go away in the end, as opposed to trying to fight it. When you try to fight, generally, when you try to fight thoughts, they end up rooting themselves even more.
Isn't this like making a bro? Isn't this like wearing gloves?
this Eitzah?
Same type of thing.
Well, so this Eitzah is more once you do this, so that I'm telling you that's what your Das is going to be like. Definitely not multiple times, correct? Meaning for him to come back and say, one second, I heard what you said about that Avodah Zarah, but I had a new Avodah Zarah that I was thinking of. Does it count for that too? No, then I don't think this would apply at all. Correct.
He does go further. He gets in the Eitzah with
Nashtah. Right. Okay. So yeah, if you read further, the Stipler does say a very interesting thing. He says that you should be mafkir, you should take away your ownership from all of your possessions, and therefore anything that maybe you bowed to, anything that was an object that was used to worship Avodah Zarah, you can't make it usur, so it doesn't become prohibited to you and all of that. So the Stipler definitely was, in his greatness, going to next steps where he was helping people with more quick fixes to try to see if that's something that could help. And it could be that the Stipler in his greatness and the reliance upon which somebody would have going to the Stipler and the trust that they had in him, if it would be a somewhat lighter case, it wouldn't be as much of a deeply rooted OCD, it could be that type of Eitzah would be enough. For example, if you have a kid who has the beginnings of an OCD, you don't start with exposure therapy at all. You start with trying to understand it, trying to recognize it, and then you tell the kid, reassurances. That's always the first step. So the kid says, I can't get in a car, it's too dangerous. You say, let's look at the statistics. It has a danger component, but as you wear your seatbelt, it's okay to go in a car. And the kid says, really? And you say, you know what, let's call an expert. And you call an expert one time, and he said, okay. Oh, okay. Now I can go in the car. There's nothing wrong with that approach. In fact, that's the right first approach. It's when the person then comes back and says, yeah, but I found that maybe this car is a little bit different, and they go on and on and on and on. When you get to the point of we're going to diagnose now, not just the person has an episode of anxiety or an episode of OCD, the person seems to be maybe at the very beginnings of it, and you try some reassurances, right? That's part of the diagnostic process. You don't just diagnose someone with anxiety because they say that they're worried about something, even if it's irrational. You try a little reassurance, doesn't work. You try a little, it's okay, just relax, use a relaxation technique, doesn't work. The basic, that even layman's approach to anxiety not working is one of the criteria that allows us to diagnose that this is clinical and not something that can be, you can just use something at a much lighter level. Okay.
Yeah, but don't you see the guy is saying, isn't he already in a later?
That was the Stipler was saying that.
No, I'm saying so, and the Stipler is saying, dude, that's.
I don't know if we can be medayik in that. The Stipler is saying it.
He's
saying from all the names, it sounds like he needs all of those. I mean, but then he said, and I don't know, there's a little bit of a Stipler personality in the way that he writes everything. I'm saying, and because he was a chassid, I added in the Baal Shem Tov, and that wasn't enough? Why not just the Baal Shem Tov?
He added in just the Baal Shem Tov, the Stipler.
He added for this Bacher.
But before that, it's the Bacher that said, no?
Oh, it was?
Yeah.
No, wasn't that the Stipler's advice?
He should have all those.
Mysterious moda. He's saying, giving him a mysterious moda. Yeah. Okay. So just to wrap up, there are other interesting topics we could save for another time in terms of. I'm going
to
take a question in a second. Just like exposure therapy. How do you do exposure therapy when the thing that the person's obsessing about involves dvarm isur? And this is a complicated question that I've seen, unfortunately, even from therapists around, not be too careful with. You can't just say, well, because I'm here to heal someone, so therefore you have to ask Shilas. You have to get an Eitzah from Das Torah in terms of where you go and how you allow a person to constantly expose himself to something that there may be an element of Isser in that type of exposure. Yeah, it's a side technical point that's interesting, but the key is that if what's driving the person is Menuchas HaNefesh and contentment and simcha, and a connection to the Ribono Shalom, that is what's going to be Yerushalayim, Avas Hashem, and you'll see it usually all over their face and their hargeshim and everything. If what's driving it is just irrational levels of fear, and never ending like they're running on a treadmill. Rabbi Metzger just told me earlier today of a friend of his, who a mechanic, who was able to realize later in his life, you know, when I was a bachur in yeshiva, It wasn't Davat Hashem and Menuchas Nefesh and Yerushalayim driving me to be the last one out of the base medrash. It was OCD. It was coming from low self-worth and low self-esteem and a tremendous worry, not about how to even, not about like my state and the relationship with the emotional world, that could be a problem too, but even amongst the other Bachrim, it was actually coming from a much more unhealthy place that he was able to recognize later in life. So these are things that we have to be on the lookout, especially when we're in Chinuch. And thank you so much for participating. I'll take questions.
You mentioned that it's genetic.
Yes, anxiety has a genetic component, for sure. But I said also that a person could not have it genetically at all, but because of epigenetics, if for years, usually, you're exposed and involved in your environment of anxiety, again, say like the Holocaust, it could actually now become, create a genetic mutation, and it could affect future generations. Even something which is genetic can be treated 100%. Whether it's usually in real hard cases, medicine and therapy combined is the best approach. The medicine tends to just lower a little bit, take the edge off, and then it allows the therapist to have more of a pesach, more of an opening to have the conversations necessary and do the tech. This is hard work. Exposure therapy, it only works. I've had many kids where it doesn't work. It doesn't even get off the ground. Because you know what? The anxiety is not bothering them so much. It bothers them, but not so much. So what's the motivation to do this extremely difficult, emotionally work? What's the motivation? You have to actually, in a weird way, it has to be bad enough in order for there to be motivation that such a difficult approach is going to work. But it works, even if it's genetic. The epigenetics goes in a good way, too.
I'm from the old guard. You just feel like those things usable.
I was just speaking to the Blue Zhivarov last week about a Bachar, Talmud, that we're working with together and working on together. And the Blue Zhivarov told me, thank you for being in the mental health profession. I won't go into all the compliments he said, but he said, this is a newer thing in Klal Yisrael. Just telling you his words. In Europe, in the olden days, there were many people who had these issues. This is his words. And they were just left to the side. People didn't pay much attention to them. There was no social media or newspapers or anyone giving them a spotlight to talk. It was easy to ignore them. They didn't get married. They didn't have children. And they just lived on the outskirts of town. And everyone knew them as so-and-so, the crazy
guy. Sessions end in 1 minute. Presenters, please dismiss your classes. When you're ready, ladies are sitting.
What?
The men are sitting in the section near the stage, and the ladies are sitting in the other half of the auditorium as you make your way upstairs. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's true. Even the time of the stipler. I'm saying the stipler, there aren't many Eitzes V'Hadrachos farm out there. The stipler was unique in handling these questions, yeah. And in giving Eitzes to these Bachrim.
Does the healthy Yiras Shamayim sometimes lead into those?
I mean, anything could lead into it, right? But it would need some sort of unhealthy bridge to get there. I don't think healthy Yerushalayim itself would lead into OCD, but healthy Yerushalayim without the guidance of a Rebbe could lead to the Bachar thinking to himself, oh, I should do X, Y, and Z as my next step in my growth without discussing it with a Rebbe and getting guidance and being balanced. And that actually is a little bit too much for him, and then he thinks, oh my goodness, if it's too much for me, I must need to do more, because who am I? This is something, must be a problem with me, and he does even more, and it's an exponential cycle, and it turns into OCD, sure. So, it can begin, but there's gotta be steps that we can trace back. If it started with healthy Yerushalayim, then it has to be that there were missteps along the way that got him there. And by the way, I'm not so into the history necessarily. Sometimes it's important for treatment, sometimes not so important for treatment. Here we are. We've arrived at this point. We have to treat this. But yes, usually you can, if you want to look at the history, you could see that. Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay,